Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Upper Big Branch Mine in West Virginia produces about 1.2 million tons of coal a year and has earned more than 1,300 citations against it for safety violations in the last 5 years. How does this happen? We've invited Mine Safety and Health News Editor Alan Smith to talk about that. Alan will be with us in a few minutes. And also Wes Addington of the Appalachian Citizens Law Center. He's an attorney there. Wes, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
It should be noted that we requested interviews with Massey Company officials as well as with someone from the National Mining Association. They didn't take us up on the invitation at this time. Hopefully the next time. Wes, isn't the job, and if Alan has joined us yet, Alan, you there? Hi, Ellen. Thanks.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us. Isn't the job of a miner just intrinsically dangerous, like the president and CEO of Massey says? Hey, it's just a dangerous job.
Well, it is. Mining is inherently dangerous, but that doesn't mean that we're not at a point in this country that technology has brought us to the point that we can protect miners. And I can tell you, even though mining is inherently dangerous, in 2010, mines should not be blowing up. That should no longer happen.
Why is that?
Because we have the know-how to prevent it, simply. So, and the fact that a mine blows up, that there's a large mine explosion, is evidence that safety was not the primary priority at that mine.
Ellen Smith, what do we know now about the suspected cause? Is it pretty much what they've been saying from the beginning, that buildup of the methane?
Linda,
Sorry, that's okay.
Yeah, I don't think we know. It can be. I mean, this was such a powerful explosion that they're probably going to look at a combination of methane and coal dust. Coal dust is incredibly explosive, much more so than methane.
Okay.
But, you know, going back to what you asked, Wes, mm-hmm. I mean, there are backup safeguards in place so explosions don't happen. You can get these small fireballs on a mine face when they're digging, when they're using these big cutting machines to cut the coal.
Mm-hmm.
And these small fireballs are instantly put out. There's water sprays. You know, you've got the airflow, the ventilation controls to dilute the methane. There's multiple backups in place. Equipment should shut down when the methane levels are high. And if everything is in place and working, you should not have these explosions. And while, yes, mining is intrinsically dangerous, we know that if you follow the regulations, it can be done safely.
Okay, if you're just joining All Sides with Ann Fisher, my guests are Ellen Smith. She's the editor of Mine Safety and Health News, and also Wes Addington. He's an attorney with the Appalachian Citizens Law Center. What you went over some possible ways that such an explosion can be avoided. Why does it take, they're saying, as long as a year to investigate this event?
I'm saying a year just from experience. With something this big, it's just going to take, you know, they've got to interview all the miners from the mine. They're going to interview mine personnel. They're going to interview family members.
Now, I've heard that they're not going to interview family members this time.
Well,
am I wrong about that?
I don't think that's a fair thing to say because they may very well interview family members to see if some of the miners had said anything to them about mm-hmm. the conditions in the mine.
Sure, they did for the Sago mine investigation, I know, but I'd read somewhere that this was not going to be the case this time around.
I don't think we can make
All
that
right.
assumption.
Okay. Regulations were tightened in 2006 with the Miner Act after the Sago mine disaster. What changed with those laws, Wes?
Well, what changed with the laws is in response to Sago, there were a number of changes to emergency response measures, and that was wonderful. I mean, for example, the addition of rescue chambers in the mine. I think what happened is we saw what what occurred at Sago, and in a direct response to that, they tried to institute measures that, if Sago was repeated, they may have been able to save more lives. And that's all well and good, and it's fine. It was wonderful. Unfortunately, I don't think we did enough in accident prevention. After the Miner Act and after Sago, there was another bill that was actually passed in the House called the S Miner Act, and it went a lot further in terms of accident prevention. For example, it gave MSHA subpoena power, which MSHA does not have currently.
Apparently this legislation didn't pass then.
It did not. It did not pass through the Senate. It had a number of provisions dealing with, making seals in mines stronger, dealing with retreat mining, dealing with conveyor belt flammability. So I think that's probably what's necessary now in response to Upper Big Branch is a focus more on how do we prevent mine disasters.
What is important about subpoena power, and why doesn't MSHA already have it?
Well, that's a good question. Currently in the law, the only way that MSHA can use their subpoena power is if they hold a public meeting. And they typically, in fact, I think they've only done it once in their history after a mine accident. So,
Tony Opegard did that in the Kaiser aluminum plant explosion.
And my understanding of that particular situation is sort of the push for doing it was in that accident, the outside community was affected because of warnings and such. So I think I felt it was more necessary to get public input. But typically, with most of these mine disasters, you do not hold a public hearing. Therefore, MSHA has no power to compel testimony, a company to turn over documents. And, the problem with that is when they're holding these interviews, and they'll be holding them in Upper Big Branch, when most of the people involved will consent to an interview, but if you get to crucial questions, and especially questions that, could involve serious liability on the company, they can decide not to answer them. And there's really nothing the agency can do to compel those answers. And sometimes those can be the crucial questions and answers that really leads to the bottom of what happened.
We were talking earlier about whether families are involved or not. Ellen, what you said that families can tell about how the miners might have been talking about their fears beforehand, that there might have been a problem before. Is that – how does that work? I mean, they're not necessarily experts and may not understand what their family members even talking about.
They're not experts, but think about that young man that wrote the note to his family saying if he died in the mine, he hoped that he would be looking down on them from heaven. I mean, what did he know? Now, maybe they don't know anything because that's all that was said, but other miners may have said things to family members. And if MSHA doesn't ask those family members, I hope that those family members will at least come forward and talk to MSHA and offer. I don't know, Wes could probably tell you more about this, but it might be viewed as secondhand information and therefore not reliable.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, but it certainly might steer MSHA in another direction.
And that's something else that the S Miner Act would have done, is allowed family members to designate what's called miner representatives. Currently in these MSHA interviews following a disaster, MSHA doesn't allow sort of any public input or any public participation. And what typically happens is you have the person being interviewed, and that person is typically represented by a coal company attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no chance for family members of those that lost loved ones or even miners that currently work at that mine to participate. Now, the S-Miner Act would have allowed those families to designate a miner rep who could have sat in on these interviews and really helps with the investigation and helps keep those family members apprised of what's happening.
I guess I would imagine that a union representative might have done that, but there isn't the union there anymore. The United Mine Workers was decertified there.
That's correct. If that was a union mine, then the union typically in most of the interviews would be able to sit in on those interviews. So unfortunately, union mines are, you know, historically union mines are typically safer, at least in terms of fatalities. So none of the Massey mines are unionized that I know of.
And there's one other point, and you know, miners may not know this, although I'm sure that they would be told. But each miner can have their own representative or witness with them. And so if they wanted a family member to be in with them when they were being questioned, they would have that opportunity. If they wanted their own attorney, frequently what we see in these cases is that the mine operator's attorney will be in on the miner witness interviews, and it will be, you know, a representative from the company and the miner. And what people have said is that they feel that that is very intimidating to the miner to have a company representative there. But then some miners ask for a company representative to be in with them. So it gets tricky.
Well, I would the business is well known for being intimidated. You hear all the time that people are afraid to say anything because they need their job.
Yeah, that's correct, and that, you know, unfortunately that hasn't changed over the years. You know, and in some ways, because of the higher paying salaries now, you know, miners and their families are economically anyway really tied into those jobs. So the intimidation factor and the leverage that companies hold over them is probably just as great as it has been in the past.
Wes, how much of your work at the Appalachian Citizens Law Center revolves around the mining business?
Well, all of it revolves
okay.
around the mining business.
Okay.
I do two things here, really. I focus on mine safety issues, and I primarily do that by representing miners who have been discriminated against in their workplace. The federal law prevents or at least prohibits companies from discriminating against miners, i.e. Firing miners, cutting their pay, transferring them to less desirable work because of making safety complaints. So I represent miners in those actions, and then I also represent miners and widows affected by black lung.
Okay. We're going to have to take a short break. My guests are Ellen Smith. She's an award-winning editor for Mine Safety and Health News, and also attorney Wes Addington with the Appalachian Citizens Law Center. If you'd like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation, clear, straight, open, from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation will be here this afternoon at 2 o'clock, and today's Wednesday, so the political junkie will be stopping by to discuss all things politics. That's on Talk of the Nation from 2 until 4 on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
53 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning, sunshine today, and a high of 75. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Traveling on down that coal town road, listen to my rubber tires whine. Well, it's a goodbye to Buckeye and White Sycamore. I'm leaving you behind. Oh, I've been a coal miner all my life, laying down track in the hole. Got a back like ironwood, bent by the wind, blood veins as blue as the coal.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That was Kathy Mattea singing Coal Tattoo. And the tattoo would be the mark that was left on a coal miner's head when a big chunk of coal fell on him. It never went away. It was a tattoo. Welcome back to the show. My guests are Ellen Smith. She's an editor for the Mine Safety and Health News, and also Wes Addington. He's an attorney for the Appalachian Citizens Law Center. I want to talk more about how this investigation will proceed. The state wants to get involved. The West Virginia State Board of Coal Mine Health and Safety wants to join the state and federal inspectors underground as they investigate the cause of the explosion from last week. Is there an advantage to having the state involved? Is it a more the merrier kind of thing?
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't know if it's more the merrier kind of thing, because I think you can have differing opinions as to cause.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do think it's important that the state investigate. And the same with other states that regulate coal mining. So, I don't see the problem with that.
Is the state regulating coal mining in a parallel way with the federal government, or does it? How does that work?
Well, it can't. The states, Kentucky, West Virginia, other mm-hmm. coal mining states, can't reduce any of federal protections in the law.
Okay.
Now they can exceed them, and obviously they can regulate areas that the federal government hasn't regulated. For example, after the Sago disaster in 06, there was a coal mining disaster in Harlan County in Kentucky, the Darby disaster that killed five miners. As a result of that, in 06 and 07, Kentucky strengthened their mine safety laws, and in numerous respects, some of those provisions are much stronger than what the federal government has.
Before the explosion, the Upper Big Branch had been charged with several dozen violations, including problems with the very elements, methane gas and coal buildup, ventilation, and more, that might have played a role in that explosion on April 5th. Why wasn't the mine shut down? How does this process work? How can you have dozens of violations pending against one location like that and have it still operating?
West?
Ellen?
I can answer that.
Sure, Ellen.
What we see or saw at this mine is that actually MSHA issued well over 50 withdrawal orders. Mm-hmm. And so if they find something unsafe, they can withdraw the miners from one section where safety and health might be affected, or they can withdraw them from the entire mine. This mine was what we call was on 103i spot inspections for the amount of methane that it liberated. So MSHA was there every 10 days or so just to check on things. And according at least to MSHA's records, they were doing these spot inspections on a regular basis. MSHA cannot just shut down an entire mine and say you will correct every single violation. And I think what's important is some people are bringing up MSHA's power on pattern of violations, and that is if violations are repeated over and over again, you have to kind of stop and fix these problems, and you can't have any significant and substantial violations.
Mm-hmm.
But under pattern of violations, you can still have violations. I mean, there's no power for MSHA to say, all right, you are just going to stop mining until you fix every single problem in the mine. They don't have that power.
Well, and if I may jump in,
sure,
really
was.
Quickly, there is one thing in the Mine Act regarding injunctions. where the Secretary of Labor could go in to a federal court and ask that an injunction be placed against the mine, some sort of restraining order against the mine, you know, for a and it's referred to a little differently, but essentially for a pattern of violation in that mine. Now, MSHA's never used that power in the history of the Mine Act, so it's unclear exactly you know, how much power that provision holds.
Well, or it's unclear what it'll take to get them to use it.
Well, that's true.
Challenge rates have increased since the new laws went into effect in 2006, the miner laws. It was at about a 5% rate back before then. It's increased to about 30% today. These challenge rates, this is by companies like Massey that challenge the citations. Is this good or bad? Why is this?
First of all, we do have companies that they've stated publicly that they're going to challenge 100% of the citations because they don't believe that citations are being fairly issued. And, of course, that is bogging down the system. And there are provisions in rules before the Federal Mine Safety and Health Review Commission that when you challenge a citation, you basically certify that you believe that there is a point of law that you will win on. So every citation that's challenged, if you are the attorney or the mine operator, you have to say, well, we believe that we can fight this. There was a case involving Marfork Coal where a judge basically told the attorney that he was abusing the system.
Told the mining company attorney?
Told the mining mm-hmm. company attorney that he was, the judge felt that he was abusing the system with all the challenges. And the review commission basically said, no, while he is challenging all these citations, they have a right to do that. The other issue where we started to see the buildup was in 2003-2004 when MSHA changed its Freedom of Information Act policies where it would no longer turn over information to mining companies or people like Wes Addington or Tony Opegard, miners' rights advocates, mm-hmm. or me, the press, where you could get information and sort of get a background on any citation or conditions. To find out if the company or the miner's representative would want to make a challenge.
Well, why was that? Why did they change the FOIA law?
It was a policy change that was government-wide. We used to call MSHA the model for freedom of information. Mm. The agency would share inspector notes and information on how they made decisions. They would share that with what I refer to as the mining community, people like Wes, the press, the local community, and mine operators. More information was above board and available. And, you know, quite honestly, in the Bush administration, there was sort of this, there was a government-wide clampdown on information that would be given to the public. And this agency was right in there with saying that we will no longer turn over witness interviews, for instance. I mean, Tony Opegard, the mine safety advocate that works with Wes, had been trying to get witness interviews for a case, and he was denied this information. And it just doesn't do anyone any good.
What do they cite as a reason to deny it? What's the ongoing investigation? I mean, what's the
because
reason?
They say that it's a law enforcement proceeding.
Okay.
And so you can't even make a decision. What you're going to have to do is you're going to have to start legal proceedings and go through discovery processes. You can't get the information first and then make that decision on whether or not you want to try to challenge something. Right now, sort of everyone's hands are tied, and you're going to have to go through the legal discovery process.
Of course, when we're referring to MSHA, we're talking about the Mine Safety and Health Administration. We're talking about mine safety right now with Ellen Smith. She's the editor of Mine Safety and Health News, and also Wes Addington. He's an attorney with the Appalachian Citizens Law Center. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. There is a backlog at the Federal Mine Safety and Health Review Commission. It's about 16,000 cases. And we said earlier, you know, they can take an average of more than a year to settle. Where does this end? It seems like it's only going to get worse, particularly if there's companies out there saying that they're going to challenge 100% of the citations.
This backlog is just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. We used to see 2,500 to 3,000 cases a year, and the judges could handle it. When we started seeing the case increases at the review commission, it was not that the chief administrative law judge did not ask for more judges. He did. And the chairman of the Federal Mine Safety and Health Review Commission, Michael Duffy, under President Bush, told me personally that they were not going to ask for more money or more judges because we had a war. We had a war on terror. And every government agency had to do their part in the war effort. And he was not going to ask for more money. And so, therefore, you just saw the cases increasing and increasing and increasing. And the judges and their staff can only do so much. Mm-hmm. The docket office did not have additional staff. They were coming in on the weekends to file cases. They were bringing in their kids. They were looking for volunteers to help file cases. And it really was unconscionable that nothing was done. And they are trying to remedy the situation right now. They have asked for more judges. They have asked for temporarily for more judges just to bring the caseload down. So if they could get, you know, 10 more judges just for 2 years and, you know, get over 20 judges just to bring the caseload back down to a reasonable docket, then they can try to get this under control. But right now, they don't have the money and they don't have the judges.
Of course, the administration's changed over. Is there any sense that the Obama administration has a different tack?
Well, they've hired more judges, mm-hmm. and they've put in a request for money to hire even more judges. They want to get up to 18 judges, and they want to open another office in some of the other coal mine areas. Right now there's two offices, one in Washington, D.C., and one in Denver. They'd like to, and by opening more offices, they're also going to decrease their travel, because right now judges have to travel out of Washington, D.C. Mm. to all these places to hear cases. So the chief judge right now, I think, is trying to, and the chairman, Mary Lou Jordan, they're trying to get a handle on this. But, you know, this agency has been ignored, or was ignored, for a very long time. Or, you know, purposely this decision was made because, you know, we had this, quote, war on terror going on. And we had, you know, troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, Mike Duffy was pretty above board about that. He just was not going to ask for more money.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And, Jerry, you're on the air. You got to turn off your radio first, though.
It's off.
Okay.
Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ms. Fisher, Ms. Smith, Mr. Addington. I can't believe this is the 21st century in 2010. This fella, Blankenship, reminds me of the character that Broderick Crawford played in the great movie Born Yesterday. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember that. He thinks he can buy anybody. And last Wednesday, front page of the Dispatch, continued on page 4 of the first section, he told his employees, don't listen to the supervisors, run coal. And then, well, I understand, and let me say, I don't have a dog in this fight because I spent 40-some years in the corporate world and management, but I know what management can do. I understand 70% of the miners at the Massey mine there wanted to join the union, but he told them, you can't do that unless you want to be out of a job, or words to that effect. Now, as I understand, and I'm not an attorney, Mr. Addington is, I'd like him to address this. That is a violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act. And why can't this man, just on what he has said and done, be indicted on reckless endangerment, Mr. Addington? Just these 29 miners that sadly lost their lives there, because the methane should not build up, and this would not happen, as I understand it, in Australia, Canada, or France, because the government put the hammer down on these type of operators. Now, I would appreciate your response, Mr. Addington, as an attorney.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, and I don't know, for example, what a U.S. attorney would do criminally outside of the Mine Act. But within the Mine Act, the only felonies available are for falsifying documents. And unfortunately, typically that occurs by your low-level management, your foreman, maybe even a superintendent at the mine. There really is no structure in place within the Mine Act to go much higher in that, in terms of holding company officials accountable.
And I just
like to add to that.
Yeah.
We do every once in a while. I make speeches on personal liability under the Mine Act, and I always keep sort of a chart. And the bottom line is, we find the frontline supervisors and the foremen are the ones who are charged and have even gone to jail.
Mm-hmm.
In these cases, it doesn't move up the corporate ladder. It really is the guys down in the mine. And this was also addressed at an Eastern Mineral Law Foundation conference in D.C. about 8 years ago, where a guy actually stood up and he said, I can't shut down part of a mine. I'll get fired if I were to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And Ed Clare, who was the Associate Solicitor of Labor at the time, said, better you get fired than a miner die.
That's interesting.
And these are the choices
well,
that these guys are faced with.
That is interesting because, you know, I'm old enough to remember when the Ruther boys, Walter and Victor, got their heads beat in the 30s because they were trying to organize unions. And I know that a lot of things about that go back to the Haymarket riots in Chicago and the place in Pennsylvania where, what's his name? Gosh, I can't think of it. The little guy was over in Scotland. Fishing for trout. Well, these shootings went on, and the Battle of the where Henry Ford's had his
River Rouge.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
But no problems. Yeah,
River Rouge. The Battle of the Overpass there, where Henry Ford's own secret police, led by Harry Bennett, fired on the on his own workers, and. I thought that was all taken care of, but it appears that avarice and greed still reign supreme in some people's minds, and I just would urge you all to keep the hammer down and don't, you know, there's two ways to succeed. Never let up and never let down.
Okay.
And thank you very much, Ms. Fisher, and your guests, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for your call. We're going to have to take a quick break. My guests are Ellen Smith. She's an award-winning editor for Mine Safety and Health News, and also Wes Addington. He's an attorney with the Appalachian Citizens Law Center. We're talking about what could be done to prevent more tragedies like the explosion at the mine in West Virginia last week. If you'd like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll take those emails and those calls when we return on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support WOSU by bidding on unique culinary-themed packages online now. With the Chefs in the City Baker's Dozen, you can bid on 13 of the most sought-after Chefs in the City silent auction packages, even if you don't have a ticket to the event. Go to WOSU.org/chefs to view all 13 items up for bid. These great items will sell on the evening of April 15th. Proceeds from this and all of Chefs in the City 2010 events will directly support children's educational programming on WOSU TV.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of the program will be here. Special coverage of the May 4th primary election will hear two points of view about State Issue 1, a proposed constitutional amendment to renew the Ohio Third Frontier program. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 55 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:41 this morning. Sunshine today and a high of 75. Clear skies tonight, a low of 48 degrees. More sunshine for Thursday with a high near 80. And then a chance of rain on Friday and a high of 69. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Say, did you see him going? It was early this morning. He passed all these houses on his way to the call. He was tall, he was slender, and his dark eyes so tender. His occupation was mining, West Virginia, his home. It was just before 12 I was feeding the children. Ben Mosley came running to bring us the news. Number 8 is all flooded, many men are in danger. And we don't know their number, but we fear they're all doomed.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about mine safety in the United States. What's being done about it in the wake of the disaster at the mine in West Virginia? A week ago, Monday, my guests are Ellen Smith. She's the editor of Mine Safety and Health News, and also Wes Addington. He's an attorney with the Appalachian Citizens Law Center. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a comment. Ellen, I wanted to talk a little bit about that, who they've appointed to lead the investigation. The U.S. Mine Safety Agency is being faulted. I read in the Washington Post on the choice of the man to lead the probe into the explosion. You were quoted in a story about that today. What's the deal?
Well, I guess I'm just troubled. And, you know, I don't want to call him a bad person. And he certainly isn't. But he did have a mine disaster in his district. It was the Darby explosion. And I just think that perhaps there needs to be more of a distance between a chief investigator or the man to head the investigation and this investigation. I mean, and again, I don't want to say that I don't I think he can do the job. That's not the issue. It's just that he did have some major problems in his district, and these issues came out in the Darby mine explosion investigation into MSHA's own actions mm-hmm. and problems. And, you know, maybe he learned from that, and I'm sure he did. But what I was telling the Washington Post reporter was that in this case, I think I would rather see an outside person come in. And I actually named a name, and that's Joe Pavlovich. He used to be an MSHA district manager in Kentucky, and he was very well respected by industry and the miners. He came in on Crandall Canyon, and this is just such a sensitive case. It's the worst coal mine disaster in, 40 years? And I think I just would have looked outside. But, you know, that's really a personal opinion. And I'm not there at the agency.
So you're saying it's more of like an appearance of impropriety. It appears.
No, I'm not even saying it's improper. I don't even want. I absolutely don't want to go that far. I'm just saying that, you know, there were problems, and it could be that because he had those problems in his district, that he is going to be hypersensitive, and look for issues for the downfalls for what happened. But because he did have that problem, I'm just saying that, you know, maybe he wasn't the best one to choose. But again, I absolutely do not want to say that there was some impropriety here. We are all human. But I think I just would have brought in an outside person. And again, it's just really a personal opinion.
Okay, well, that's fine. That's why we have you on the show. 614-292-8513. And Gary, you are on the air with Ellen Smith and Wes Addington. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, I was curious about something. With all this talk about the methane gas, the coal dust, and so on coming out of the mines, since they have to evacuate it anyway, so I can't imagine why they haven't come up with a more productive way of possibly using these coal mine products, byproducts, into some type of a product that could be used down there by the local residents, and for whatever the method, and have it be a good situation for everybody going all the way around. Because all I've heard this morning is a lot of negative talk and somebody getting sued and lawyers and judges and so on coming in. But there's got to be some way to put this coal dust and methane gas to a productive use outside the mine, since they have to evacuate it anyways. I mean, we do things like manure for spreading on crops, and diesel fuel is a byproduct of gasoline distillation, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why, instead of putting so much negative spin on this, of course, there was 29 lives lost, don't get me wrong, but there ought to be a profitable byproduct that the people in West Virginia could benefit from. And by the way, I travel down there on business, so I see what goes on down there a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
I see the roads, I see the residences, I see the people. And so I know a little bit about the area, but I can't believe that there aren't some methods that could be applied to recover some of these dangerous byproducts and use them productively.
Are there incentives for the mining companies to do something with that methane besides just vent it?
Well, some companies actually do degas their mines and collect the methane and sell it, and they hire outside companies to do that. And I know that they do it. I don't know enough to speak to that issue, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But there are mining companies that do it. They do it down in Alabama. It's been done actually in Ohio, I think, when Southern Ohio Coal Company used to have its mines. So companies have captured the methane. They've done pre-drilling. But why Massey does or doesn't do it, with some of these more gassy mines, I just can't answer that.
I asked if there were incentives, just because I would imagine Massey and any other company would be doing it if there was a profit involved in it, if it would earn them money.
Yeah, I don't know enough about that market to be able to comment on that.
All righty. Gary, sorry we couldn't help you with that.
Not helping me, it was just a thought.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Take care. Charlotte, you're on the air. You want to talk about two things. Let's talk about one first. You want to talk about Massey's contributions to politicians?
Yeah. I have a sneaking suspicion, follow the money. If you want to know why it will take so long to investigate this mining accident, then you tell me how much Massey and the coal industry spend individually and in the aggregate on political contributions each year, and to whom do they pay it? And the other thing I wanted to mention was, I've worked in a very deadly environment. It's called a hospital where it is inherently germy, full of bloodborne pathogens. I worked with all kinds of sharp tools, and I worked with all kinds of cancer-causing and explosive chemicals as just part of my job. And any supervisor who had told me to work without gloves or without washing my hands or to work with those dangerous chemicals under a hood that was malfunctioning,
mm-hmm,
and not equipped with a manometer to monitor that hood 24/7 would have been fired.
Okay, so now are you going on to your second issue? Because let's stick with the first issue.
Okay.
Okay. We can't, right. I can't handle this.
Okay. Okay.
So what about it? I see that Mr. Blankenship contributed the federal maximum of $30,400 last year to the National Republican Senatorial Committee. For starters, he also supported Senator James Inhofe from Oklahoma, GOP Senate candidates Pat Toomey, Pennsylvania, and Rob Portman of Ohio, for that matter. So do you all follow the money, Wes, Ellen, and look for this kind of influence?
Well, we can all follow the money, and that's where it comes down with legislation and who is elected. But in this case, you've got Joe Main, who used to head safety and health for the United Mine Workers, who now heads MSHA. There's no following the money on him. You can follow the money in Congress and say, you know, who did or didn't vote for the S minor legislation and why. But, you know, the people at MSHA, the majority of people are career people. They've been there a long time. Because they are career, they do have to follow the dictates of the political appointees who are put in power. But right now, those political appointees are Greg Wagner, who used to head NIOSH, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, and Joe Main, who, you know, headed health and safety for the United Mine Workers. So when it comes to at least MSHA, you cannot make the argument about following the money.
Wes?
Well, yeah, and I agree with everything that Ellen just said. Mm-hmm. And the time it takes to do the investigation, I can't envision that being politically motivated in any way. It's just after mine disasters, these really are large investigations, and they can take some time. You know, whether, you know, 6 months is sufficient or a year sufficient, I can't answer that. But, you know, they do typically take upwards of a year to do.
Okay, we have a couple more emails. My guests are Ellen Smith. She's the editor for Mine Safety and Health News, and also Wes Addington. He's an attorney with the Appalachian Citizens Law Center, and we're talking about mine safety in the United States and specifically West Virginia. Right now, this is from Kelly. It appears that hearsay may present itself regarding the family interviews. How can a sense of truth be remotely guaranteed given that each family member has a motive to proffer information that is damaging to the coal company? Now, we were talking about, you know, the idea of families being interviewed for the investigation. Is that an explanation for why that might be a problem, Wes, or not?
Well, I mean, you could get into issues of hearsay through interviewing the minors. So, I mean, that, you know, that's going to come into play no matter who's being interviewed. I do think that if some family members do have, you know, particularly relevant information, then the investigation should cover that, hopefully. So, you know, I don't, you know, and obviously people doing the investigation can weigh that hearsay versus, you know, some sort of direct knowledge of events, you know, and those determinations can be made. So just because something potentially might be what we would call hearsay doesn't mean it shouldn't be considered.
Okay. Yeah, Ellen?
No, okay. I agree with Wes, yeah.
Industry officials have said that the backlog that we were talking about earlier isn't a safety problem because that regardless of whether a challenge is filed, that the mine still is required to fix any safety problem. Is that the case?
Wes might have a different take on that, but I've been saying that from the very beginning. I mean,
that's the way it's supposed to work.
One of the things that Blankenship said in a statement to the SEC is he wanted people to know that you know, the majority of citations were fixed the day that MSHA issued the citation, and that's true because they couldn't keep operating. They do have to take care of the problem, but, you know, the large numbers of, it's not just citations, but of these withdrawal orders, you know, did show a problem at the mine. But I'm not sure if that answers the question or not.
Wes?
Well, you know, obviously it could be a safety issue just because of the amount of time that it's taking to resolve a lot of these, you know, and I mean, there can be a lot of peripheral issues. You know, for example, the morale of mine inspectors in issuing citations if they know it's going to take years to resolve them. So, I mean, you know, that's really difficult to quantify. So,
are there enough inspectors?
Well, MSHA, I believe, is just about at 100% of what they need. One of the problems the last couple years was inspectors were retiring and they were not being replaced. And then MSHA had cut down on its regular inspections, so if it did a spot inspection, it would count that in what we call its regular inspection data. Robert Byrd has made sure that that's taken care of, and when MSHA's asked for certain money in the budget, Robert Byrd has said, no, we're giving you more, and you will hire mine inspectors. So MSHA's actually reporting last year for the first time, I believe, in its history, It completed 100% of all inspections of mines. So at least at this point, they do have the inspection, the numbers.
Now, I've read where there's questions about the training, however. They're not necessarily well trained.
Well, you know, these are new guys, and quite honestly, I mean, from my side of the industry, the complaints are that these new inspectors are overzealous. Not that they're missing things, but that they're actually oversighting. And that's the industry complaint, and the complaint made to congressmen all the time is that they lack training, so therefore they are citing things. They're maybe giving high negligence to something that's no negligence, or they're citing something that a mine operator may feel isn't even a violation, although that seems to happen a lot. But the problem has been with oversighting, not undersighting, but it doesn't mean that undersighting could happen. And, you know, the bottom line is I don't know who inspected this mine. I don't know how much experience they had. So, you know, we certainly can't comment on that, but MSHA will probably look into it.
Wes, what's the process now as far the legal process at this point? There's going to be the investigation. It's probably going to take about a year. What do folks like you do in the meantime?
Well, personally, I continue to litigate my normal case.
Okay.
I don't know that there's, try to find out as much information as you can. For example, in the Darby investigation, and this is why I said it was, you know, important for more involvement in these investigations. In the Darby investigation, an attorney that I work with, Tony Opegard, basically they had miners designate them as miners' representatives and were able to sit in on the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So basically the families had a direct channel to what was happening and had timely information about what witnesses were saying, you know, whether that conflicts with other things that were being heard in the community. And I assume that's the kind of thing that's going to be happening in the Upper Big Branch investigation. You know, hopefully those families will have some sort of representation in the interviews. I don't know if that's happening or not.
We're out of time. My guest, Ellen Smith, editor of the Mine Safety and Health News, and also Wes Addington, attorney for the Appalachian Citizens Law Center. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
Appreciate it. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.